Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Well, good morning, Justice Moore. How are you today?
I'm well, Rich. Good to see you.
Happy Thanksgiving. How was your holiday, sir?
It was great. Lots of family togetherness. Yeah. You know, we used to live a long ways away from the Twin Cities and frankly didn't get many visitors over the holidays. And Now we live in Northfield, and so everyone wants to come to Northfield, which is great. So we contributed a little bit to the local economy through some of my family. And
thank you very kindly.
Yes, it was good. How was your holiday?
Oh, it was great. I was up in my cabin. Just my wife and myself. Our youngest daughter was with her in-laws, and our older daughter was on call for her job this weekend. So Annie and I just went up to our cabin ourselves, and first time we've ever spent Thanksgiving just the two of us. And it was, I'm not going to say it was bad, Gordon. It was, it was pretty good.
Sure. It was really relaxing.
Oh, it was great.
You see much wildlife up by your cabin?
You know, there's not as much. We're in northern Wisconsin. There's not as many deer up there as you would think, which is the case actually across the northern upper Midwest, UP and northern Minnesota. Deer has sort of, the winters have been especially hard lately on deer, and so they've all moved south. Some occasional, like, you know, every now and then there's a beaver or something like that, but not a whole lot. It's just really, the Northwoods is beautiful whatever time of year you're there. So it was fun.
Sounds wonderful. Sounds like a good place to be today.
next year, maybe you and Jane can join us, so we're not all alone. So we are deep now into the court calendar. You had one pretty high profile case that you probably can't speak too much about over the last month since you and I last spoke, but can you give us a little bit on the case involving former President Donald Trump?
Yeah, Grove versus Simon, the effort to keep presidential candidate Donald Trump off the Minnesota primary and general election ballot, and the court issued an order dismissing the petition with regard to the primary ballot, basically deciding only that particular question. The court relied on an earlier case, this De La Fuente case, that basically says that the state political parties more or less have control over, you know, who goes on the primary ballot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a matter of political party initiative and discussion. And we could talk for 2 hours about this case nonstop, but I will just say there's a lot of interesting legislative history in this Minnesota presidential primary. We've gone between caucuses and primaries, and you know the parties have been given a lot of authority over that, and so the court adhered to its prior precedent with regard to the primary ballot. Yeah, the order makes it quite clear that that was without prejudice to a potential subsequent challenge, depending on what happens with regard to who goes on the presidential ballot or who is submitted as a candidate for the presidential ballot by either party or any party, frankly. So that was it. It was I think, a very historic case, a lot of media interest. It was part of a November sitting that was frankly very intense. We had four first-degree murder appeals, which each one of them, you know, usually involve horrific facts, tough issues, and those go straight from the district court to us. There's no intermediate appellate decision on that. So we are acting as both the error-correcting court in those first-degree murder cases and the precedential court if we're going to announce any new rules. So we had four of those cases, which in and of itself would make for a healthy month, in addition to other post-conviction relief cases and petitions for review. But adding that with the Simon Grove versus Simon case made for a really intense November.
Almost a little bit grueling.
It was a little much. Yeah, it was.
When you guys are presented a first-degree murder appeal, are you reviewing the way the case was tried, or are you having to go through all of the evidence and actually reviewing the verdict itself?
All the above. I mean, it depends on what issues are being challenged by the defendant, but absolutely, we are looking at oftentimes sufficiency of evidence arguments, questions about whether or not evidence was improperly excluded or improperly admitted, and the effect of jury instructions on guilty verdicts, behavior of parties during closing argument. I mean, the whole gamut of issues that come up in appeals from, you know, convictions. And just so the public's clear, only the defendant gets to appeal after a criminal conviction or a criminal trial. If the defendant's acquitted, the state doesn't get an appeal. The case is done. So these are defense appeals from convictions in first-degree murder cases, which are the most serious type of homicide under Minnesota law, sometimes involving life in prison sentences.
Okay. You know, just out of curiosity, does if you uphold a guilty verdict in a first-degree murder case, does the defendant then have the right to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, or does it have to be specific reasons for that?
Yeah, there has to be a federal connection, either constitutional or statutory connection. If it is just a evidence sufficiency issue, that will not generate a federal question. However, if we were to rule, for instance, that, you know, the defendant's rights under the Fourth Amendment search and seizure provisions were not violated by the way police obtained evidence, that could be the subject of what's called a petition for a writ of certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay,
that is a Hail Mary pass in most cases, frankly. Yeah. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court takes very, very few cases, and, you know, they really look for cases that involve issues that have been decided differently in different parts of the country to try to, you know, bring issues together. So, it for all intents and purposes, we are the end of the line, but we occasionally there are petitions filed. We've got a few pending right now on our docket from last year, and we wait and see. Sometimes they're granted. I would say on average in a 5-year period, probably we have a couple that do make it up to the Supreme Court, and they don't have to be on criminal cases. They could be on civil cases. The one that one issue that got some notoriety was Hennepin County and the you know, seizure of this woman's condominium regarding tax forfeiture liens. Yeah. That case got up there. But for the most part, we are the end of the road.
Just real quick, back to the Groh versus Simon case. Do you have any sense if that is going to be appealed, if they give the plaintiffs are going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court, or are they going to let that sit for now?
I have to be careful on this because it's a pending case, and I don't want to suppose anything. Okay. But I will just say this, Rich. That case was decided on purely state law grounds.
Okay.
I don't think it really sets up a federal question. Not yet, at least. The Colorado case, on the other hand, that was ruled on a few weeks after ours does, because in that case, the district court judge ruled that presidential candidate Trump was involved with an insurrection on January 6, 2021 in Washington, but that the type of oath that Trump was required to take as a presidential candidate and as a elected presidential nominee, it was not the type of oath that the insurrection clause applied to. And there are a lot of differences of scholarly opinions on this.
Right.
So those issues do present constitutional interpretation questions that, in my opinion, are likely to find their way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay.
Whether that happens prior to the case coming back to us, I don't know. Right. That's speculation. Yeah. But I don't think the order that Chief Justice Hudson issued in November is likely to get appealed.
Okay. Well, I'm going to retract my question, and then we'll just move on. You have a big day today. It's a big day for the state Supreme Court today. There's a little bit of a celebratory atmosphere around the court today, isn't
there? Yeah, there is, Rich. Today in St. Paul, the court has the public investiture ceremonies for Natalie Hudson, who was appointed Chief Justice by Governor Walz back in late September and assumed the role privately in early October. This will be her public investiture, and she will be the 23rd Chief Justice on the court since 1858. And then Carl Procaccini will move into Chief Justice Hudson's former Associate Justice spot as a new member of the court, being the 96th Justice on the court since the first three were appointed in 1858 after statehood. So they will have a joint ceremony, and there will be an appropriate amount of pomp and circumstance, although it won't be over the top in any way, shape, or form. But it will celebrate and recognize really the historic nature of Chief Justice Hudson's appointment as the first African American ever appointed or elected as Chief Justice in our state's history. I'm pleased to report she's doing very well in her first 2 months on the job. I think she's finding out what we all suspected, that there's a lot to that job that none of the associate justices really had a clue about.
Right.
And only if you've sat in that chair and had to make the tough decisions do you know. And it's really kind of overwhelming. It's really two jobs. I mean, you're doing the justice job of hearing oral arguments and issuing opinions, and you're running the entire court system. And we have a court system in this state comprised of 322 judges as a part of it, 296 district court judges, 19 court of appeals judges, and 7 Supreme Court justices, plus referees, child support magistrates, and all the infrastructure of the court system.
That's a lot.
Our court administrators, clerks, court reporters, bailiffs, interpreters, the document acceptance teams, these are the people that keep our system running. Couldn't do it without everybody pitching in. And the important thing is that, you know, the court system has a leader, and it is the Chief Justice administratively, in addition to being the person who presides over formal court sessions and oral arguments. So there's a lot there, and we will celebrate that later this afternoon, and that will be fun. It's the first public investiture ceremony for the Supreme Court since, I think, Justice Thiessen in 2018, because when I came, it was 2020, and there was just nothing done publicly. We had a ceremony in the courtroom that was live streamed. I'm not sure how good the technology was, but that was what the world allowed at that time.
Yeah.
And so this is the first time a public ceremony has occurred in 5 years, so it's a big day.
Is there any disappointment that you didn't get a public investiture, and we all got to celebrate you? Or
you know, I Rich, first of all, first and foremost, I had the good fortune of having a public investiture in Worthington in 2012 when I was appointed. I had my family, friends, people who I'd worked with, and other members of the court system. So I had the good fortune of having that experience. I think about those judges in the state who were appointed to the district court at the same time I was appointed in the Supreme Court that never got a public investiture of any sort. There are two other members of the Court of Appeals, Judges Frisch and Judge Gaitis, who were appointed during the pandemic in circumstances like me. They both were district court judges, but they didn't get a public investiture ceremony. So, you know, I'm like the others in similar circumstances. And frankly, I was not comfortable with doing something 16 or 20 months after I started. I mean, to me, that just seemed kind of silly. We don't need to have a coronation ceremony to ratify something that's, you know, particularly when the voters have already spoken in the fall of 22. It just seems like it would be really,
you're right.
It would just not be.
It'd be for show at that point.
It would. And we don't need that. We've got more important things to do. So no, I'm fine to celebrate with the other members of our court, and we're looking forward to it. I know there'll be members of the Judicial Selection Commission there, federal judges. We're going to have some music. It's going to be a fun day.
Okay. I've got a weird question to ask you, and I frankly, I don't expect this to make any difference at all, but I'm going to ask anyway. With Justice Hudson taking over as Chief Justice, your position, your physical position on the bench changed. Does that make any difference to you at all? I mean, were you sitting on the bench?
if you look at our formal photograph, which is now on the state website, indeed, yeah. I am now on the left side as you face the bench. I was on the far right side. And that's just the history and tradition of the court. The Chief Justice is in the middle, and the more senior members of the court are closest to her. So, mm-hmm. yeah, my vantage point did change a little bit. I don't think it really means much other than, you know, it reflects a change in the court. We're going to have some additional change coming up in 2024 with Justice Barry Anderson retiring. Yeah. He's reaching mandatory retirement, so that will ensue another move of some sort. And then there are some chambers moves that could occur. There's some chambers shuffling that occurs within the court. Not me this time, but it could next time.
Mm-hmm. Has he made any formal announcement about retirement?
No, he has not. Okay. He'll be finished by operation of state law in October of 24, the end of the month.
Okay.
I think tradition holds that most members of the court will leave prior to that. Not always. Some have stayed until the last day, but oftentimes you'll see justices going at the end of the court term, which mm-hmm. is in the end of July, sometimes earlier. But the important thing for a justice that's retiring is that all their work has to be completed before they walk out the door. I mean, they can't come back and work on opinions, sign things. Once you walk out that door, your authority ends. And so all their work has to be completed, including separate writings. And so there's sort of a scramble to make sure that that gets done. So that'll be a 24 issue. But there will be some, after 3 years of, three and a half years of, well, not quite three, 3 years and a few months of sort of, you know, stability, we have some change. So
yeah.
I think it's good for the court, frankly. I don't think there's a bad thing. Call it term limits, call it, mm-hmm. you know, the law about retirement. Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, there's a good argument that everybody, you know, that gets to the court have a run and then decide to call it, call it a day and let other people come forward.
I think anybody personally, this is my personal opinion. This is certainly not the opinion of necessarily the opinion of the Justice Moore. Anybody serving in public service, especially at the high level like you are, there should be a set amount of time, be it a mandatory retirement date or a couple of terms. You know, I think about somebody like Senator Dianne Feinstein, who just passed away, who was probably 2 years beyond being able to execute her duties as a senator. And she should have retired when her previous term expired. I like to see the fact that we've got with the state Supreme Court, we've got some limits in place, and it also I'm a believer in getting new blood into what we're talking about, and if you can introduce different opinions, that's always a good thing.
Absolutely, there's discussion about term limits for the U.S. Supreme Court as a result of kind of some of the same discussion.
I would be strongly in favor of that.
Yeah, Justice David Souter is an example. He left after 18 or 19 years on the U.S. Supreme Court and still fine. I mean, he mm-hmm. still serves by appointment and designation, I think, on some federal circuit cases.
Oh, is that right?
But yeah, he said, look, I've had my run. He had a good 18 years. And that, I think, is the number that I'm seeing in discussions about possibility for term limits. That would be a big change. There aren't any constitutional limits on the length of time a justice can serve. It's a lifetime appointment under Article 3 of the Constitution. But whether that should be changed is an ongoing discussion. I agree with you, Rich. I think any of us in our position, you know, we're privileged and honored to be in the position that we have, but I think we run the risk of really getting ourselves with, frankly, some inflated egos if we mm-hmm. think we're the only people in this world that could have a way to contribute to the Supreme Court.
Right.
There's a lot of voices out there. There's a lot of energy. And frankly, it is a demanding job. It is you hear sometimes, you know, surgeons say, look, it was time for me to step back and you know, let people, with, you know, a little younger than me go in this. And there's a little bit of that feeling to the Supreme Court. I mean, there's a lot of collective wisdom that age and experience brings, but, you know, you need to be on your game.
Right.
You need to be, thinking about things. And so, each of us has to reach an individual decision on that. And it's sensitive because nobody wants to be told what to do. But as you point out, there are some people that even if colleagues tap them on the shoulder and say, look, maybe it's time to consider stepping back for reasons of pride or arrogance or whatever, don't do it. And then that becomes, as you point out, a potentially difficult situation. Yeah.
And as you say, there is, you get to a certain point with a certain amount of time, wherever you are, there's wisdom that comes along with that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, we're going to ask you to change your role and step aside and now go and teach what you've learned to a younger generation.
Absolutely.
Too,
we have justices who do just that.
Yeah.
Rich. Justice David Lillehaug, who I replaced, he's at the Fredrickson firm, consulting on appeals, doing markups of briefs, advising on oral arguments. You've got justices that have gone into alternative dispute resolution.
Yeah.
Some that have gone back to practicing law, many that teach. That decide, hey.
I remember seeing Miles Lord on my on my TV talking about personal.
Yeah, Miles never got to the state Supreme Court, but he was a federal district court judge with, again, a lifetime tenure. And, he went back to work. So there are every justice, every judge has their own, kind of plan for that. And I do. I think there's a lot that members of the court can bring to law students, to the practice of law, serving on advisory committees, being involved in bringing some of that wisdom to, discussion of important public policy issues.
Yeah.
One of which I'd like to get into just a little bit here, because I think it's really important.
And I think we should actually get into it right now. The United States Supreme Court is about to hear, or the United States versus Rahimi case, is that, or have they heard it?
They heard it a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah, Rahimi, for those who may not have paid a close attention, involves a challenge to a federal law that takes guns away from people subject to domestic violence restraining orders.
Mm-hmm.
Most states have, in Minnesota it's called a domestic abuse order for protection. Basically, it's a court order that prohibits people from having contact or committing acts of domestic violence. And as part of the law, judges have the authority in most states to, order that people not possess firearms. In fact, they can be ordered to turn them in, to have law enforcement go and search houses to find them.
Wow.
Because of the unfortunate, sad correlation between domestic violence and gun-related homicides.
Sure.
And so when the court decided to hear this case, immediately, everybody knew this was going to be one of the bigger cases on the docket this year. Advocates for domestic abuse victims hoped it could provide an opportunity for the court to really ratchet back the sweep of last year's blockbuster Bruin decision that expanded gun rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a real tension here between, various interests on display in Rahimi. And if we could just talk just a little bit about the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
We could have a Steve Poskanzer and three or four other professors at Carleton.
Absolutely.
We could have a term of discussion on the Second Amendment. But just basically here, the Second Amendment in its relation to federal, state, and municipal laws is obviously really important regarding who can possess firearms. And I'll give a little bit of a trigger alert here. This is a difficult subject matter. It involves a lot of competing interests and obviously a lot of hot button political issues.
Yeah.
And I am not here to express any comment on any case pending or likely to become before the state Supreme Court. And I want to emphasize this is not a political discussion, but just a public policy discussion. And the reason I thought about this, bringing this to the legal talk, was a series that was done in the Washington Post just recently. And I, again, with a trigger warning, if you've got the ability to look at this story that the Washington Post did, posting photographs of the result of shootings at churches, mosques, schools with AR-15s.
Wow.
They made an editorial decision to publish photographs that had never been published before, not showing you know, decedents, not showing, mm-hmm. but the carnage related to it. Yeah. And Rich, this story is a gut punch. It is really difficult to look at. And they obviously agonized editorially over whether this should do this, but,
right.
and this was really a comment on the AR-15 and the ability for it to do mass destruction, but it relates to this whole discussion about the Second Amendment,
sure.
because of how the Second Amendment's been interpreted by our Supreme Court. The images in this story, the one that just haunts me is the image of a row of body bags in the Uvalde school in Uvalde, Ooh. Texas, with children in them, just lining the hallways. I mean, you don't see the kids. You don't need to see the kids. You see what went on in that school. And I don't care what your politics are, whether you're a gun owner or not, you're a hunter or not, there's got to be some unifying belief in this country that this carnage has got to stop. This is just beyond the pale.
You know, I was privileged to be invited last January. Law enforcement agencies from across southern Minnesota came together to practice how to handle a school shooting, and they did it at Northfield Middle School, and they weren't kidding around with this thing. They had actors in there who were posing as students who had been injured, who had been killed, and without the actual carnage, right? Just to see what they presented as. What you can expect as far as casualties go. It'll haunt me for the rest of my life. I mean, it makes you sick to your stomach to think about it, because you're standing in a school where your kids went to school, right? And this is what could be. It really has to give a person pause. It has to.
It does, and I don't know if any of our listeners followed the journey that some mothers of school students in Nashville, Tennessee took, that were their kids were at this private school that was unfortunately the site of a school mass shooting. And these moms unified and went to the Tennessee legislature, mm-hmm. and the Tennessee governor to try to get some changes in gun laws,
yeah.
and fought the battle. And these are not, you know, let's just say these are probably not, you know, the most politically left people in
sure,
the world at
probably
all.
Probably not.
But
yeah.
they're just, you know, they just enough.
Yeah.
And it got the Tennessee governor, who's a, you know, conservative Republican, mm-hmm. to bring in the Tennessee legislature back into a special session over a lot of pushback. And I don't know how much got done,
right.
but there was an incredible amount of attention brought to this important issue from you know, perhaps people who normally might be considered a little bit strange bedfellows, including those two young men who were expelled from the Tennessee legislature,
right.
for their vocal advocacy on the floor,
yeah.
became unified in this particular issue with some of
yep.
these mothers. And I thought their courage was really, really remarkable. But back to the law.
Yeah.
So the Second Amendment is a document that's been just studied over the centuries.
Right.
And what it says is pretty simple. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's it.
Mm.
But what does that mean? That provision was ratified in 1791 after the Revolutionary War, where, you know, the focus was on militias resisting
right.
Oppression from the British government.
Right.
The firearms involved at that point were muskets, simple pistols, and single-shot rifles.
Yep.
What does that mean to 232 years later, when we have weapons of war like the AR-15 and these bump stocks that are able
yeah.
to turn a regular, you know, gun
into an automatic
machine gun?
I would even ask how in 2023, going into 2024, how do we define a well-regulated militia?
Right.
Even the words well-regulated. I mean, I you know, there are private militias in this country right now.
Right. right.
Are they well-regulated? Like, you know, there's a lot to go that goes into this. Now, you know, fundamentally, right, what they're saying is that should the United States come under some sort of oppression or aggressive action again, the people have the right to bear arms against that.
Right.
But that's at least how I interpret it.
So the state and federal courts have historically looked through two models to interpret this Second Amendment language. One is the individual rights model, which basically holds that individuals hold the right to bear arms. And that's the model that basically has prevailed. Yeah. The collective rights model held, on the contrary, that the right is dependent on militia membership. And the collective rights model was rejected by the Supreme Court in favor of the individual rights model, beginning with this District of Columbia versus Heller decision in 2008. The Supreme Court there held that the federal Supreme Court held that the amendment protects an individual's right to keep a gun for self-defense. And this was the first time the court had ruled that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual's right to own a gun. In subsequent decisions, McDonald versus Chicago and Catalano versus Massachusetts, the Supreme Court clarified that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment incorporates the Second Amendment against state and local governments. And then in 2016, in that Catalano case, ruled that the Second Amendment extends prima facie to all instruments that constitute bearable arms, even those that were not in existence at the time of the founding, and that its protection was not limited to only those weapons useful in warfare. Now, the Heller case made it clear that there is not a unqualified right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner for whatever purpose. And the court made it clear that concealed weapons prohibitions have been upheld under the amendment or state statutes. And the court took a pains to say that the opinions should not be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions or qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. The last term, in June of 2022, the Supreme Court decided this Bruin case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. And there the court made clear its commitment to what I think scholars have called a history and tradition-bound method of constitutional interpretation. Mm-hmm. Bruin, the court devised a test under which contemporary gun laws can survive Second Amendment scrutiny only if the government can demonstrate that they are consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. So the requirement that present-day gun laws resemble gun laws of the distant past prioritizes history and tradition over, you know, maybe other public policy concerns of today. And so the challenge with this test is that the history and tradition methodology puts emphasis on laws enacted in eras like the 1780s when the original Constitution was ratified, in the 1860s when the 14th Amendment was ratified and drafted, moments in time where notably neither women nor people of color were able to fully join the political community, played no roles in enacting laws, could not vote, were considered property in the case of African-American people. And so, you know, the struggle that the court has with this history and tradition test is how do you make sense of the, you know, laws at the founding versus laws today? And so lower courts have, since Bruin, invalidated regulations and limits on firearms at the subway, theaters and concert venues, even at summer camps, all because those prohibitions lack a direct historical analog. And so this has become a history test, really, where you have to come in and show, if you're the government, that in 1791 we had an analogous law that prohibited this type of restriction. Lower courts have also struck down a federal law that bans the possession of guns with removed serial numbers, as well as the Biden administration regulation of ghost guns, with lower courts deeming those measures insufficiently rooted in history and tradition. Well, that's not really surprising because the founding fathers did not tow guns on subways and possess firearms with serial numbers.
Right.
They didn't exist.
Exactly.
I mean, there wasn't a machine gun. We didn't have an AR-15.
No.
So the history and tradition method produced the lower court opinion in this Rahimi case, which is a tough one. Rahimi's case involved this law of disarming domestic abusers, and the lower case struck this down and sided with the defendant after finding that basically there wasn't an analogous law restricting the ability of a domestic abuser to possess firearms at the founding. Rahimi's case is not the most sympathetic for the gun rights folks. Rahimi became the subject of a domestic abuse violence restraining order after assaulting the mother of his child, then repeatedly defied the order, threatened different women with a gun, and opened fire in public 5 times.
Wow.
Yet the lower court invalidated the law under which he was convicted, maintaining there was no robust historical tradition of disarming people subject to domestic violence order of protection, which is probably clearly the case. I mean, let's remember history and tradition at the time of the founding with regard to the treatment of women in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just be blunt about it here. The amicus briefs submitted in favor of the government by historians and scholars talked about the principles that gave husbands legal authority over their wives under this doctrine of coverture. They had the prerogative to, quote, correct, unquote, or, quote, chastise through force or violence. And there was an active debate regarding how domestic violence was even perceived in the 18th and 19th centuries. And so the question is, do we rely on history alone at whatever level of generality to determine whether contemporary laws are constitutional? And, you know, the question here is, you know, how does this test really work? And at oral argument, the Democratic appointees were really pushing the Solicitor General hard to ask the court to basically disavow this Bruin test from last year, mm-hmm. which the Solicitor General probably wisely did not take up that line of attack, but made an argument, I think, that seemed to be gaining some traction with the court, that the law could be upheld under the history and tradition test. But it does raise, you know, fundamental challenging difficulties with regard to how we look at laws intending to regulate the ability to possess weapons under this historical vision of 1791 vis-a-vis today.
I want to ask you a very, very, very broad question, and I'm not sure you can even answer it at this point. As a justice, when you are asked to interpret the Constitution of the State of Minnesota, right? How much common sense are you allowed to bring into your judgment versus legal precedent?
Well, we decide cases based on the rule of law.
Yes.
I mean, this isn't just a sort of gut level analysis that, you know, this feels right or this feels wrong. But I think, you know, part of the job of a judge or a justice is to think about the ramifications of decisions that are issued mm-hmm. and the effect of those decisions on people and the people who are affected directly by them.
Right.
And, you know, we ask jurors as part of our district court jury instructions to use common sense in their analysis of complicated issues and to rely on that common sense and life experience. And I think back to the whole question of, you know, gravitas on the court and why we want people that have some life experience to be judges. Mm-hmm. And we don't necessarily, you know, want our bench to be just, you know, with brand new lawyers that haven't had that experience is just because of this issue, Rich. We, you know, there's got to be some life experience and common sense brought to challenging problems. On the other hand, the law is the law. And if the law, you know, leads to, you know, absurd results, generally, that's for the legislature to correct. I mean, you know, we're not the judiciary are not the legislative branch. We are not the best place for public policy discussions to occur over really difficult issues like gun regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean by anything that I've said to imply that I've, you know, I got any particular position on these things. But the Supreme Court, in my opinion, has painted itself into a difficult corner with this history and traditions analysis.
Yeah.
Because it really, I think just based on, you know, what you talk about, common sense restrictions on certain types of people, you know, not possessing guns.
Right.
You know, ironically, Rich, this argument is being raised by Hunter Biden and the prosecution that, you know, he's being charged with, you know, possessing, I believe, a weapon at a time when he was actively using controlled substances after telling the U.S. government that he was not when he applied for the permit. And, you know, is that a restriction on gun regulation that relates to the founding? I mean, you know, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, that argument can go both directions.
Right.
And I think, you know, I think many of us yearn for a functioning legislative branch in Washington that can address some of these difficult problems, which I think you read stories about there being behind the scenes consensus of, but because of, you know, certain interest groups and political money and the desire to be reelected to Congress, it can be very difficult for people to take courageous positions on, on public policy questions. And, you know, the question every time one of these horrific mass shootings in a public place takes place is, you know, how much more? How much longer are we going to tolerate this?
Right.
And, you know, it's a complicated issue. I mean, you know, mental health problems are very often involved in these situations. There are, you know, human beings making decisions on issuance of gun permits. You know, we have federally licensed firearms dealers who are making responsible decisions regarding who not to sell guns to. Unfortunately, there's black market for weapons. There's, you know, people have access to guns that aren't being sold by responsible firearms dealers. And so it's a very complicated problem. And I don't mean to suggest that there's a panacea here that's going to fix this very challenging problem. But when we look at 2023 laws through a lens of 1791, I think we have to ask ourselves, is that prioritizing history over, you know, the evolution of society and as you put out, common sense? I mean, I love history. I'm a history major.
Me too.
I mean, these are fascinating debates about what did Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and others mean by some of these words. The Constitution was kept deliberately vague in places because of concerns about the ability to get the thing ratified by different states with different agendas.
Right.
But how those words from that founding era are interpreted today affects us all, and I think, you know, people should be aware of that.
Frankly, I would be willing to guess, not having ever had a conversation with any of these gentlemen, but if you were to ask Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and George Washington their interpretation of the Second Amendment, you might get three different answers there too.
You well could. And in, like, in the Simon versus Grow case, I mean, the articles on different sides of what, you know, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment means, I mean, I think the amount of paper generated by that case, if it was all printed off, was approaching 1,000 pages. And, you know, there's a lot of scholarly debate about these issues. They're not easy. They're not cut and dried. You know, Steve Poskanzer gets to teach constitutional law at Carleton College.
And, you know,
I mean, these are the sorts of things are perfect for that type of liberal arts area. I think there's a similar class at St. Olaf. And, you know, I would encourage students and I would encourage all citizens to become interested in familiar and engaged with this issue.
100%.
We've got elections coming up. Elections do have consequences.
Completely.
You know, on the state and federal level and local level. And so this is one issue I thought I would bring up. In January, Rich, I think we'll talk about another challenging constitutional issue related to the administrative state. There's two cases that are on the Supreme Court oral argument docket in January that could have a real effect on the ability of the government, again, to regulate certain challenging issues.
Almost to function. We're talking about the Chevron doctrine which allows for the legislature, as I understand it, to delegate some authority as far as oversight goes.
Yeah, it's about executive agencies and their ability to interpret laws and what type of deference should be given to their interpretation of some of these ambiguous provisions.
Yeah.
You know, how much should the so-called administrative state be allowed to make decisions on things that, you know, arguably could be issues for the legislature to address, but right. if they're not addressing it. And so, yeah, the Chevron doctrine has been the subject of a lot of scholarly discussion, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more in January.
Okay, but, well, I will look forward to that. Well, this will probably be the last time we talk before the. Do you guys get some time off at the holidays?
We do. And I guess we didn't talk about maybe we could talk about this in December. I was already fast forwarding to January, but yeah, we do get a little time off at the holidays. So yeah, we'll have a December show.
Good. Well, yeah. I'll be here if you want to come in. Yeah, absolutely.
Let's have a December show. Maybe we'll transition to something a little lighter and save Chevron for January in any event. But yeah, we have a December calendar, as I discussed. We've got 10 cases, one day less than usual because of the judicial conference. But we have 2 first-degree murder direct appeals, 1 post-conviction relief first-degree murder and attorney discipline case, 6 petitions for review. So yeah, that's December. And then we get right back at it in January. So, yeah. You know, there's a little bit of a break around Christmas time, great. Thankfully.
Well, Justice Moore, fascinating stuff as always. And we thank you for coming in and talking to us today.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Rich. And I wish all our listeners, happy Christmas season coming up here, Hanukkah, holiday, whatever you celebrate.
Sure.
And we are fortunate to live in a country where you can have debates about important issues like this
yes.
without being
thrown in jail.
Navalny, Alexei Navalny in the Soviet Union or yeah. Russia, I guess that's a Freudian yeah. slip, but is not only is he in prison for his vocal resistance to authority there, but his lawyers are.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the old, Richard III, the first thing let's kill all the lawyers, that old
yep.
adage. That's exactly what this is about.
Yeah, it is.
It's not about, lawyers are annoying and should be removed from the country. It's like lawyers are an impediment to tyrants existing and imposing their wills on things, because if there's a rule of law and lawyers are there to uphold that and judges are, then you have a functioning society. And when you don't have those things, you have a non-functional society. And sadly, we're seeing that in all too many parts of the world.
Right? We are indeed. God bless the lawyers.
Well,
everyone.
At least some of them. Yeah, most of the time.
All right. Justice Moore, thanks a ton. We will see you again third Monday of December.
Yes, we will be back hopefully at our regularly scheduled time. And looking forward to it, Rich. And we'll come up with hopefully something interesting to talk about.
Sounds good. Folks, Justice Moore will be back next month. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time on Legal Talk.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.